Session number 3190, reel 2.
So Alec Corriton, Reel 2. In 1920, you were sent on from Kenley to be a flying instructor at Cranwell. How did you find life at Cranwell compared with Kenley?
I didn't care for it very much. It was what I call absolutely full of hot air to me in those days. In fact, I was made in charge of the airman's washing, I remember. It was very dull.
How much flying instruction did you
have? We used to fly every morning. Chaps from the Cranwell cadets, we had three each, I think. And I was in Sammy Maynard's flight, the Maynard who eventually went to Malta. A fellow called Gibbs, who was now an air marshal, was in the flight. Myself, and I can't remember the other chaps' names.
Did you have any other duties besides flying instruction and airman's washing?
No others. As far as I remember, no.
Did this leave you quite a bit of spare time?
No, I don't remember. I think I used to go out with the Beagle sometimes in the afternoon, but I don't remember anything else. It's a long time ago, I don't know.
In 1920, you were posted to India, to 31 Squadron in India. Where were you initially based in India?
Cawnpore. I joined the squadron at Cawnpore. Dreadful place. The airmen were in General Wheeler's barracks of the mutiny days. And most antediluvian everything. Bullocks dropping the buckets down wells and pulling them up for the water. Oh, awful.
What were your living accommodations actually like?
Several of us had a bungalow, and we lived in this bungalow, three of us, three flight lieutenants, all lived in the same bungalow. Of course, one had a bed and all that sort of thing, and choke it out, look after the place, went around all night coughing to make sure you knew he was there. And a gardener chap and everything else, but I didn't care for it very much. In the afternoon and the evening, one went out to the club and played tennis.
Was it extremely hot?
Extremely hot. And Cawnpore was very damp too, that was the trouble. I was about 110 and wet. Because later on, when the squadron got to the shower, it was 110, just as hot, but it was dry, and of course it wasn't so bad.
Did these conditions affect the planes at all at Cawnpore? Oh,
it was a monsoon that affected the planes. It suddenly got this really hot, dry heat, and then you got a flood of water coming down in the monsoon, and then the wood used to absorb the moisture, and all the struts would start bending under the strain they were on. Dreadful it was. It let out all the wires to make certain the struts didn't bend too much, because you couldn't have a bent strut. A bent strut has no strength at all. It's got to be straight.
At that time in India, the RAF was extremely short of money. What ways did that affect you?
Well, I remember one or two machines had practically no elastic on the undercarriages at all. Elastic to spring the axle. And people were putting on ropes to assure they didn't break, that sort of thing. And engines were ghastly. If anyone had a Rolls-Royce overhauled engine, they wouldn't let it go for all the tea in China. And I remember being ticked off by Wing Commander Fowler, I think I can mention his name, for saying that we won't have a Karachi overhauled engine. Well, I mean, the poor airmen at Karachi overhauling engines never seen one before of this sort. And they, first of all, they might have a Bristol fighter engine. Then next, they'd have a rotary from a snipe or something. Could they be expected to do it? Oh, dreadful place, Karate Depot, I think.
Where had the good ones been serviced?
The good ones are brand new from Rolls, you see. And you kept them, you wouldn't let them go to repair. Oh, no. I'd much better stick hold of them.
Did you look after your own engine?
I looked after my own, oh, yes, certainly I did. They absorbed a lot of manpower in those days. Because there were a lot of split bins. Oh, compared to what there is today, I don't know about today. I mean, I'm so out of date.
Was it difficult to keep all the planes in the squadron operational?
Oh, very much so. I suppose we averaged about 8 serviceable out of 12, you know, but not more. Then when we moved to Bashar, and I went on 3 months' leave, and they had a terrific gale during the monsoon, which blew down one of the hangars, and eventually when I came back, I only found one serviceable aeroplane, I remember.
How much were you personally paid in the way of salary?
850 rupees a month. And a rupee was 1 4. Sounds tremendous, but you provided everything for yourself, you know what I mean?
Did you find you were short of money personally?
No, I didn't.
What about the mess?
The mess was just a bungalow we hired, and we had a very good mess corporal who ran it, and it was a very good mess indeed, rather considering.
What was the incident you were telling me last time about the cigars?
Well, the AOC came round, and we knew he was fond of cigars, and so it was arranged that someone should go to Calcutta and buy some Corona cigars. Well, he only bought a dozen. Well, that was not much good for a mess, and we were told, all the officers were told, they can't have one, entirely for visitors. And the AOC, when the cigars were handed round, took two. This was far too much for L.A.C. Wilson, the mess corporal, who calmly, as the talking was going on, just slipped another one back into the box. It's all right.
What sort of people were your brother officers in the RAF at that time?
Oh, those are very nice ones, but there were one or two rum ones, I don't mind telling you. Very, very curious people.
What were their peculiarities?
Well, they were a bit quick-fingered, you could describe it as, you know what I mean? And I remember there was several rows with the people, the natives, you know, selling clothes and all that sort of thing.
Did they also put their fingers on the RAF mess funds and so on?
No, I don't. They never got on to the mess funds. They always remained. No trouble about that. But they always got into debt with these poor native. We used to call them boxwellers, you know what I mean? People would come around with a box of rubbish to sell and that sort of thing.
Did those sort of people remain in the RAF?
No, they went. They vanished. About 3 months in the squadron, they were off.
Quite surprising, really, that they got in the first place.
Well, I mean, they were what I call the residue of the war that was left over, you know what I mean? But they disappeared very fairly quickly, really.
What were conditions like at Peshawar when you moved there?
Well, we moved out. It was a very great improvement on Cawnpore, I'll say that. But it was never what I call luxurious. We had a bungalow down right on the edge on the cantonment wire. And really quite a modern bungalow. And I remember surviving a sort of minor earthquake and all the lamps were shaking. Didn't fall down on us or anything like that.
Did you have any air conditioning of any sort?
Oh, my God, no. No air conditioning of any sort, size, or description. Oh, no. What difference that would make?
Did you have a native with a fan at all?
The troops did. The troops had what was called a punkawala. And he sat at the end of the corridor and the fans were all these things overhead. And he had a rope from one foot onto this thing, and he kept on pulling it backwards and forwards. And to give the poor troops in bed some air breathing over them. And he was going to, the poor Pankow, he was going, if he stopped work, got everything thrown at him by the troops.
But you didn't have one, yourself?
No. We had electric fans. The only trouble with electric fans, some of them sometimes fell off the ceiling. And we had a poor flat son hurt by a fan falling down on him when it was running.
Was he badly hurt?
So he went to hospital, I think.
Now, what sort of training did operations did you do while you were in India?
Well, we were called out on many, many occasions to bomb some trucker tribe who wouldn't do what they were told to do. And we used to go and... I don't know whether they were warned in advance or not, but we used to go and shoot up anything we saw moving around where they were living, you know what I mean? I can't think now, really, what was bombing their houses and that sort of thing. And they all went away. I mean, I don't think we hurt anybody.
Were these quite frequent occurrences while you were there?
Well, not very frequent, but I mean, I suppose from Peshawar we were called away about once every 2 months or so or more. Then we might go down and stay at a place for 3 or 4 days and carry on.
Did you do these operations as a squadron?
Well, the whole squadron would go there. All the serviceable aeroplanes would go to it. And then there were other things like escorting pickets. When the army were moving out of stuff, they'd go and picket all the hills around where the road went. That sort of, and you used to go and do a sort of escort to them. And you had a panel which told you if they wanted you to bomb something, which pointed towards where it was and how far off it was. So we're called the Puff and Panel, is it? Yes, that's right.
Then there was another thing that you did, the spotting for guns.
Spotting for guns, we did quite a bit of that. Very interesting it was too, because I remember one place called Rosmacnarai, where about 5 minutes on the elevation of the 9-inch how made the difference whether the gun went over, the shell went over into the valley next door or hit the top. And I remember the section of there were two sections of that heights of battery. One was in the plains of India and the other one was on the frontier.
How accurate were the artillery?
Very accurate. The Heights was very accurate. But a gun, of course, is a flat trajectory, you know what I mean?
Tell me about the device that you invented for training in cooperation with artillery.
Well, this was simply a training device where you could do all the representative duties of directing the gun from air by air observation. We had a sand target on a slope and a fellow sitting right up high so he could see what was going on. And we had two rifles mounted so that you could elevate and depress them and traverse them. And you could, with a scale of a foot to 100 yards, you could work the codes and everything else down from up the fellow up there with the key to the chaps working the battery.
What was that actually called?
It was called the Cottage Miniature Range. And each squadron had them in India, and it's home. When I got home, I found that the squadrons at home had them. For instance, the old ceremony I went to eventually, there were two. One belonged to the school, and one belonged to the squadron.
Did you get any reward for inventing this?
I got £150.
How did that come about?
Well, there was a major in the gunners, and his name I remember at the moment, who I knew very well, and he was on the air side in the oil office. And I told him about this invention, and he didn't do much about it. But eventually I found at the senior army officers course, I met another gunner who said you must apply. And so I wrote a letter to the Air Ministry applying for an award. And the Air Ministry sent the letter to the War Office. And thank goodness my friend at the War Office eventually got hold of it. And I got 150 quid six or seven years after I had done made the first set. And subsequent sets were made by our lady at Farnborough, I think.
Was this necessary partly because of a shortage of ammunition?
Yes, well, that's what really brought it up. There was a paragraph in the Army Training Manual for the year, I don't know what the year was now, saying on account of the shortage of practice ammunition, all batteries near miniature squadrons with current miniature ranges should take the opportunity of practicing on them.
When you were in India, you told me that there was one instance where you did manage to get hold of some live ammunition to use.
Oh, yes. That was when they got hold of live ammunition for 15 pounders when they rearmed the Khyber Pass with 18 pounders, because originally it was all armed with 15 pounders. And we had a friend who commanded an Indian pack battery right at the very foot of the mountains pass, and he pinched these guns coming back and the ammunition. And every Monday we used to send a 3-ton Leyland lorry out to tow one of the guns away to some place where it was fit to shoot and with the ammunition. And we used to practice shoots with air observation with this battery and the 15-pounders. We must have run out of ammunition in the end. I don't know what happened to them in the end.
Was there any limitation on the number of bombs that you could use in training?
Now, wait a minute. We had an 8-pound practice bomb, I think. I don't remember any trouble over the 8-pound practice bomb. It just made a little tiny puff of smoke. No, I don't remember any trouble on that.
What did you do when you were on leave in India?
I went shooting in Ibex in the Himalayas. Which means went by train to Royal Pindi, and then I took a taxi to Srinagar, and then I started walking, and I walked 305 miles with a party of natives, a kare, a cook, and two coolies running to the camp. Before I started shooting, or trying to shoot ibex. Eventually I shot two, which I wouldn't do today.
Were they difficult to shoot?
Oh my God, they're terrific. They're mountain climbers by excellence. Oh, you had to start very early in the morning. You spotted them the night before where they were, and you knew they'd come down to the nearest bit of grass to feed, off the snow. And you'd have to do a night approach, so to speak, and hope that when your light came, you had them within view. One thing they didn't mind was noise, because the mountains were always coughing out stones and things were always rolling down the mountainside. But the wind, if they once smelt you, you wouldn't see them for miles.
One thing that occurred to me, now that we're coming to the end of your period in India, was it suggested to you, or did you ever think of going to the staff college, the recently opened staff college?
I wasn't interested in going to the staff college. I didn't think that side of the world didn't appeal to me at all.
And it wasn't suggested to you that it would be a good thing for your career?
No. Eventually I was pushed there, though. No, I was much more interested in the aeroplane side of it all, you know what I mean?
When you came back from India, we've already talked a bit about the job you had at the Inland Area Headquarters. So let's move on now to 1925, when you took command of 16 Squadron at Old Sarum. What was the role of 16 Squadron there?
Well, it really was the squadron attached to Southern Command, and in particular the 3rd Division. Southern Command headquarters were at Salisbury, and 3rd Division headquarters were at Tidworth. Tidworth, that's right. And you had to attend the gunner practice camps and all the sort of exercises that they did.
What sort of exercises did you do with them?
Manoeuvres, you know what I mean? Yes, just sort of all these sort of planned invasions of proper army training, you know what I mean? Because you started off, you see, by having, was it, company training, then you got a battalion training, then you got a brigade training, and then you finally got to command manoeuvres.
And what was your role, the RAS role, in these manoeuvres?
Well, doing the reconnaissances and that sort of thing. And you had a radio telephony tender at the unit you were working with, like 3rd Division, and you had the radio telephony for reconnaissance reports from the pilot and all that sort of thing.
Did you do any actual practice, any bombing with the army?
No, didn't do any bombing. No bombing in front of the army, no. I don't remember that. Oh, no, that'd have been an awful lot of safety precautions over that. Practice camps, of course, were numerous. We had a practice camp down on Dartmoor from these. Oakhampton is Dartmoor, isn't it? Yes. And a flight used to go down there and stay there for... Well, we practically occupied it all the summer. And various batteries used to come in, and they had trained all these batteries as they used to turn.
The RAF had something of a reputation in the 1920s for rather wild behaviour. Would this have been justified at all in the case of your Army Corporation Squadron, 16 Squadron?
No, I had no trouble in that way. There were some officers I would like to have got rid of, I must say, but I couldn't find enough to hang them on, you know what I mean?
What sort of things did they get up to?
Well, they're just idle and inefficient, you know what I mean? Couldn't rely on them.
Were these people who served in the First World War still?
Yes, some of them did. And some of them were on attachment from the army, too. I can remember some names in my head now. Troublesome ones, you know what I mean?
How did the ones on attachment from the army actually get on?
Some are brilliant. One officer came from the army, a gunner, absolutely brilliant, and he ended up as a lieutenant general, this, that, and the other. Oh, yeah. And there's one I know now living in Scotland who, I'm told, he has a picture of every airplane in the Air Force, or still as an album, you know. Oh, he was a delightful chap too, absolutely reliable.
In what ways were they particularly good at the work you were doing?
Well, I mean, if you had them to send them out to do a shoot on Lark Hill ranges with some gunnery show, because the gunners were running courses there, demonstration shoot, they wouldn't go and make a mess of it. You had enough troubles with the wireless sets without having anyone, not knowing the right drill, you know what I mean?
Tell me about the early teething troubles that you had with radio telephony.
Oh, Lord, awful. The worst one of all was the generators. You switched on the generator. There was a little windmill thing on the wing, and it wouldn't generate any electricity. And you came back, before the fellow came back, landed, and our wireless sergeant, who was a very good chap, used to get a battery and put the wires onto the terminals and gave it a hand start, electrical start. And I saw this going on, and so I said to him, why don't we take a battery up in the airplane and have a button that pilot just pushes? And that moment on, he did well, and that moment onwards, we didn't have electrical failures in front of everybody else, you know what I mean? The volume wasn't generated, just pressed the button, it came on. Oh.
Were there any other things that you could do to the sets to improve
No,
them?
Really. And then you said we had one fellow who did nothing but select the valves. There were 7 valves in the set. I think it was called the R31, I'm not certain. And if you got a good selection of valves, the set was quite different from what it was with a poor selection. And this fellow was a marvellous. He used to run the RT tender. And I remember he was called... The Darcy's tender's code name was Daffodil, and he was always known as Sergeant Daffodil.
What sort of range could you achieve?
30 miles. You've got everything going well, 30 miles, but then you had a fair bit of height. Height made a lot of difference. Not more. Well, you might do more if you're lucky.
Was that the sort of average?
No, no, the average would be below 30, I think.
Round about what was the
20, average? I think. Then I think you want at least 5,000, 6,000 feet for that. I don't know, not now.
And did they frequently pack up and go wrong?
But no, they'd hold it while they were going, you know what I mean? The only thing is that makes sense, the blooming generator would come on, but then we finally cured that. And then the Air Ministry, I remember, coming back to me this, the Air Ministry brought out some new brushes in the generator, and they were called GC4 brushes, and they were far superior to what the old ones we had. Were they GC4? I think they were GC4.
And in what ways did they improve the performance?
Well, I mean, the generator would come on by itself without our electric devices getting it to go.
Was the whole business of using these sets and spotting for guns something that required a lot of training?
You had to, both sides on the floor and in the air, had to stick to the drill. You were talking to each other in a two-letter code, and you had to know exactly what was meant by everything. And if you hadn't got the people familiar with the code without looking up things, it was pretty well hopeless, you see. But familiarity with the code and the wireless set that's working, it was not so difficult.